Welcome to the Forever GMs podcast, the roundtable where two professional game masters dig into the craft of running games for a living alongside other professionals in the RPG industry. I'm Liv.
I'm Doc. And today we have with us Jason Pitt of Genesis of Legend Publishing and Jeff Stormer of the Party of One podcast. Welcome, Jason and Jeff. How are you today?
Doing great. Happy to be here. Go Birds.
I am happy to be here too, and I'm glad that the world is not completely frozen today.
That is positive.
That is positive, yeah.
This is always a concern from Canada. I'm sorry.
That's real and that's true.
That's fair. I live just across Lake Ontario. We're not quite that frozen, but sometimes we get it.
Also, love this conversation because we're recording in March. This is not going to be out until like May or June.
No, I know.
The world will be warm.
Not in Canada.
We may have a snowstorm where I am. Before we get going, I'm going to start with a game spotlight. And today, because our topic is about running longer or shorter games, I thought a good one would be one that you can kind of easily adjust with that. And also, it has one of the most unique mechanics I've ever seen, a game called Dread. Dread is a game where it is a horror game, and in it you play potential victims. You play the jock or the stoner or the characters that are archetypical for the horror genre, or there's some different play elements that you can kind of go into and play some different variations on that theme. And as you go through it, you basically you narrate your actions. The GM will kind of say, okay, you're doing this. Anytime you do something, though, that could have bad consequences, which is a lot of different things, you pull a block from, I'm going to call it a stacked block of towers, but it's also better known as a Jenga tower. If that Jenga tower falls over, you die. And that's the mechanic of the game. It also has some built-in stuff to make sure that if you die early on, you can kind of keep playing. It's built in such a way where, as a GM, you can basically say, like, this seems fine, this seems fine. Or you can just every little thing, if you want to get through the game fast, which I kind of like. The other thing I really like about Dread is that it has been hacked so many ways for other games. One of my favorite ways is for a game called Starcrossed by Alex Roberts. And Starcrossed is a game where you play two people. It's a two-person game with a facilitator. And you play two people who are not supposed to fall in love, but are falling in love. And when the Jenga tower falls apart, so does everything. That's a great variation on it. I recommend Dread. It's designed by, I should have practiced this one, Apita Ravakal.
Epidaya Ravishal, or Epi for short.
Epi? Great. Hi, Epi. Come on the season two.
We'll get your name right.
We'll get your name right, I promise. But it's a fantastic game, and it's a fantastic mechanic. Obviously, we've got some experience with it.
And just the inner game master, I just have to toss in. I think the coolest thing about Dread is when the tower falls, it technically doesn't mean the character is dead.
Okay.
It means they stop having the narrative immunity of being the protagonist.
Oh.
So you could just rocks fall and they die at any point whenever you want, which is even better.
Yeah.
Because now you've got this looming tension of there is a sword of Damocles hanging over my head right now.
That's fantastic.
I love that.
Jeff, have you played?
Oh, yeah. I love one of my favorite experiences in games ever was a Dread game. And I played at a convention back in 2018, 2019, maybe. Premises that we were all toys on a bookshelf that were trying to like stop the thing. And my character was like a discarded G.I. Joe action figure that sacrificed himself to get eaten by the family dog.
Very Toy Story-esque.
Very Toy Story, very the Christmas toy, and sort of the big climactic. And the thing about Dread that I really like is that, like, every player has the option of knocking over the tower. Like, you can say, so, like, we've reached a point of, like, we were, the tower was looking sus, and we all kind of looked around, and I saw the moment, and I was like, This is this character's moment to do this to save everyone else, and everybody else got to walk away from the encounter because one player like threw him very literally threw himself to the wolves. It was a really just wonderful game experience.
It's funny because I've actually never gotten a play droid. I own it. I own literally the only reason I own a Jenga tower because I've shaky hands, so I should not play Jenga in general. But every experience I've heard, like you read through the book and it's like basically the Friday the 13th horror movie is kind of the thing that I don't know. That's what came into my head as I was reading through the book. Every experience I've heard of Dread is not that. It's some other entire thing, and it's great.
One of the coolest things watching someone play the game, like the emergent property, is as the game progresses, people's chairs move back away from the table. Because there is a rule.
Oh.
If the tower falls, even if it's by accident, it fell.
Yeah.
So people get more and more careful and back away from the terrifying tower.
I like this, like, affecting the physical space around the table effect this game has. It's really fun. Yeah. I've never played Dread, but I've played StarCross. I've actually bought StarCross for two separate couples this year as a birthday gift.
It's a good birthday gift. It's a good gift. It's a good couple's gift.
It's a perfect couple's gift, and I love the Jenga system that it uses to, like, create decisions. I think that's so fun. I do want to transition because I feel like it's a good transitioning point to our first question. Running long and short games, whether that is the really tiny 1 hour adventure you run with some friends on a Wednesday night or a 12 hour D&D campaign ender that you're running. And so I wanted to start with our first question for today, Jason and Jeff. Why might someone, either a GM who is absolutely insane or a player who is in it for the short or long haul, be interested in a 1 hour adventure or even an 8 hour marathon? Like, what's the decision making process that you've made or you've seen people make for these?
From the short side, the decision that I made is to live in a world, unfortunately, ruled by capitalism where... And to have made the unlucky draw by way of background and educational choices where I got to wake up for work tomorrow. That's kind of really, I think, that's the crux of the decision for me. I mean, jokes aside, like it is for me, it is very easy to slot an hour into my day. It is very easy to slot 90 minutes into my day. It is very easy to, you know, grab 2 hours, grab 90 minutes, grab whatever, and like... It is a very easy, approachable thing. It is not a demanding experience. It means that, like, I can make plans later tonight. I have, you know, if I'm like, oh, we're going out to dinner after this, I'm not like, well, I will see, you know, I'm not telling my wife, I will see you tomorrow. That's kind of where I think a short game becomes really powerful, is just in its ability to allow you the experience of play and allow you the joys of play, but also fit into a life schedule.
I have a similar response that's also quite different. I am also motivated by the horror that is capitalism. However, that's because as a game designer and publisher, the best way to get someone to buy your game is to run your game. The best way to get volume...
That's true.
Is to run lots of different games with lots of people or have a very big game. I could run 4 1-hour sessions and run 16 people through it, or one 4-hour session and run 4.
Yeah.
One of those is going to let me pay the bills.
That's a really good point.
More than the alternative. I mean, I'm not paying the bills regardless in the RPG industry.
You're getting closer to paying the bills with the...
Paying,
4 1-hour game.
How about we take the S off of paying the bill?
Singular
and
bill.
We had a really good month. One of our bills
was
the
electric being on. It's great.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that there's also this kind of advantage because I think everybody kind of has this feeling of like, oh, I just don't have much time. When you put out a game that plays in an hour, I think that there is something that people are like, oh, I can play, like, it's a selling point for a lot of games, like
For the Queen,
Mask of the Mummy King from Nathan Pauletta, Swords Without Master.
Yeah.
Formerly in Worlds Without Master and now standalone. Thank you, Kickstarter. There's a host of others, but yes, For the Queen is an excellent example of that.
A few that come to mind for me, In the Air Tonight by Evelyn Ramsey is like a very short two-player game. It's like an interpretive card game. Liv, you mentioned For the Queen. I think any kind of Descended from the Queen game is a nice, easy 90 minutes to 2 hours. Yeah, those kind of games, like, it's very easy. And it's, which I think also kind of brings up to me, like, another point of, I think, in favor of that, which is I am someone in particular. A lot of my work is pitching games to people who don't play games. You know, a lot of the podcast is me sitting down with people who are not games people. It's real easy for me to pitch a game where I can go, we're going to go from zero to finished experience in 90 minutes. Like that is a commitment that I can pitch somebody and I can say, you're going to have a wonderful experience. You're going to go on a journey. You're going to feel some feelings and we're going to wrap this up in less time than it takes you to watch a movie.
One thing that I wanted to raise is in my experience as Forever GM, I find that it's a bell curve in terms of how long a session can take and how easy it is to run the game. And that bell curve peaks at around 3 hours. A 3 hour game is the sweet spot for me. When it's a convention and there's 4 hour time slots, I aim for a 3 hour game.
Sure, that feels great.
With slop room. So we can cut out early or we can go long depending on the energy at the table. But if you plan a 4 hour game, well, you've got a 4 hour and 15 minute game and everything just imploded.
Yeah. It really does.
But people's energy and in some cases ADHD meds can last about 3 hours, typically. If it's going more than that, you really need to have a break midway through. So there's different difficulties on both sides of that bell curve.
Totally.
I noticed that Jeff was carefully dragging it away from 1 hour and towards 90 minutes.
That's rare and that's real.
1 hour is an absolute Herculean task.
1 hour, you've got to do a lot of prep. Like, you got to do a lot. You got to be ready for to be in and out in an hour. I've done out like 90 minutes is good. I've had Party of One episodes that are 60 minute games where we are in and out in an hour. And those are the ones where I'm like cracking my knuckles before I hit record. And I'm like, I know how this is going to go. We're going to do our bits. We're going to hit the beats and we're out the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Young Dragon Slayers, which me and Jesse are professional GMs for, our games for kids are 90 minutes. But within that 90 minutes, there is a understanding when I schedule and I start every quarter telling kids this. We start like at 10 minutes past the hour. You do like your bits, your funny stuff, your catch me ups. We go over inspirations. And so those games end up being closer to like an hour and 15. And that is like a we start running. When we start and we don't stop.
That's it. You hit the ground running and you get 75 minutes. 60 minutes is a 60 minutes is a tough play.
So the thing is also that with a 60 minute game, you need to plan that. Just like for a 6 hour game, you also need to plan that with about the same level of rigor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the 1 hour you're trying to cram everything in, make sure that there's enough variety that everyone gets to participate, everyone gets to do their bit. 6 hours, you have to maintain the pace, ensure that energy is maintained over time. The sprint and the marathon are both very difficult, whereas I like being lazy, and that's why the 3 hour sweet spot, I can just improv that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's enough flexibility that I can just run wherever the story takes me.
Yeah.
But I can't do that for a 6 hour game either. That will become very painful on hour four.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny. I feel like we're answering the question that I was to ask. And I think what I actually would like to talk a little bit more about is like, what about those like marathons? Like, what are the circumstances where those are beneficial?
For the long, long games.
Are there any?
I can tell you the specific circumstances where like Because in 90% of my life, in my professional life, in a lot of my games life, for friends, I'm looking at a two to three hour experience, and I'm in and I'm out. The area there, I will say, the joy to me at you know, 30 years old is if I'm looking at a 16, what I'm really looking at is, you know, my friends have rented a cabin. We are locked in. Like, we have got drinks, we have got food, and it is to me, like, there is a getaway factor. To me, there's almost a vacation element or a day trip element to it, where, you know, I think Jason, you're exactly right about the bell curve of difficulty, but I think that it kind of mirrors to me it's a different joy, I think, is how I would describe it. Like, there's a different joy in, like, I've had this experience, I'm in and out, I got 2-3 hours, 90 minutes, whatever, like, and then there's a joy of, with, you know, again, to that question we'll discuss more in a bit, but, like, with breaks and all that stuff, if I've taken 3 days, if I'm taking a long weekend, and we're just, like, exploring a world and laying out characters and doing all of this goodness, like, there's a magic in that, where there's just a, like, wandering kind of lyrical energy that I think is really, really, and a chance to kind of, like, dig your teeth in and explore a world that I think is magnificent.
Yeah.
I also find that those kinds of longer term, they do fabulous work for episodic type stories. So a beautiful movie example that I highlight is The Green Knight.
Oh,
yeah.
If you watch The Green Knight, it is not one scene. It's, what, 6 or 7 different scenes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That are episodic and sort of self-contained.
Sure.
And you just go from this one to the next one to the next one. And you can't really tell, is this done? Is it going to continue? Because it's sort of a self-contained chunk. Those kinds of situations where, how many episodes are we running for? That works very well for extended.
You know what's another good movie? I think another good movie example, I think, that pairs nicely with that. I love that you went with The Green Knight, because my brain immediately goes to, like, the movie that I think everyone in my life, I've threatened to make them watch, which is the recent silent film comedy Hundreds of Beavers, which is, like, a movie, but really a Looney Tunes style collection of 3-minute set pieces around, here's the trap that this man has made, here's the bit, and you watch the bit play out, and it's exactly that same experience. I think about that with a lot of movies that people say, like, oh, this could have gone on for 12 hours, is that experience of, you see the bits, and you see the games, and you see the episodes, and the character things, and you're exactly right. It's where you get that infinite expansive space of, like, it feels like we could put a trillion things here.
There's also this very interesting dynamic in play of reincorporation.
Or,
when we are running campaigns, we naturally prune content,
mm-hmm.
and we only reincorporate the most important aspects that stick with us personally. We're still running off of short-term memory in that 6-hour game. You can get more reincorporation more easily and draw very different connections as compared to what you would do in 3 2-hour games versus 1 6-hour game.
It makes sense, too, because the group that I've played with for a long time ago, we used to play once a month, do this huge long session. There were times it was 12 hours, but the GM was fantastic. And I used to describe it as, like, most sessions we did when we played, it was like a song. And it was like, and you get through the song and everything. This is like a symphony. And, like, everybody kind of had their own thing going on. And then by the end of that session, like, he'd bring everything together and have this big set piece where everybody would be involved and all their things would kind of fall into place. And it was just brilliant. And I think that that's the kind of thing you can do with a marathon, where you can't, if you're sitting there with an hour and a half, or if you're sitting there even with 3 hours, like, it's hard to have everybody kind of have their own thing. But it's also really hard to have everybody have their own thing and have everybody engaged at the same time.
Yeah, there's definitely a level of norm you have to have for longer games. Because I know I've experienced this personally, where I've been a player and a session takes 8 hours. And I don't know if you guys know the average attention span of a human being. It's not 8 hours. I'll tell you that right now.
You know what? You got breaks. You gotta have breaks.
You've gotta have breaks, or like even a norm that's like, hey, if these two players are doing something, it's okay if you have a little side thing going on over here, as long as it's quiet and not distracting from gameplay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. I think there's like maybe this idea sometimes that like everyone needs to know what everyone's doing. Like, catch them up.
Yeah.
People are human. It's okay. Have kindness for yourself and for your players. And I think that's a really big, like, any GM who's done that with me, I've really appreciated.
I think to that point also, like, I say this partially also to say this is a thing that has happened to me, and don't let this happen to you. Don't let this happen to your tables. A clear expectation of the length of game. A clear expectation of we are going in. I've been podcasting and I've been doing actual play for a very long time. And the number of times I've said, this is going to be a short game. We're going in for 90 minutes. And then they go, cool. So we're all locked in for 6 hours, right? And I'm like, no, hold on. Let's chat here, because I've got questions and concerns. Having that clear expectation, you know, explained up front of like, this is how long we expect to go. These are the norms around get up, take a break. Being explicit about those things, because also, you know, you run into things, and this might just be Jeff's neuroses, but like, there's a politeness issue of, am I going to disrupt the table if I go and get up and take a walk for a minute? Being clear about like, hey, we're going to be playing for 8 hours. This is an all day event. You can get up and get a water. You can go take a break, take a smoke, whatever you want to do. Like, go do your thing, because this is going to be a long haul experience. I think setting those expectations up front, or conversely, the opposite of that is saying like, hey, this is going to be 2 hours. Do not come in thinking that you are going to be playing for 12 hours, because that's a very different experience. Setting those expectations up front, I think, is tremendously helpful to just get you in a mind space so you know how to prime your attention span for the experience.
This is, for personal games, I've actually been doing a system that is not mine. I learned it from a friend, but we have like a schedule. And anyone who knows me knows I love a schedule. And so like, our games start at, the doors open at noon for our games. We start at 12:30. We play until 2. We take a lunch break. And then 2:30 to whatever that end time is, another hour and a half. But they're 4 o'clock and the last section of games. And like, a norm where it's like, you will sit for an hour and a half. Within there, you can get up and like take a bathroom break. Like, I'm not going to force you to sit down and like not take bio breaks if you need them. But like, the understanding, like, if you want to order Starbucks, if you want to go and like get lunch, there's a time and place for that. And there's a time and place for gameplay. And just like having those really hard set expectations of like, where this is what we're here to do, and here's when we're here to do it for, is really important.
I'm wiping away a tear, but just a beautifully laid out schedule is, they should have sent a poet.
It comes from years of suffering.
I see the scars, because they're the same scars that I have, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, like, there's a lot to be said for that. That's never something that I've ever done, and I feel like if I was ever in a group that would doing marathons again, which I don't anticipate that happening for a long time, but who knows? My daughter's almost 3. So when she gets a little older, she might be like, Daddy, I want to play the really long game. Or she might be like, you're a nerd. But
I will say the graph from like college to like as you age every year of how long of games you can play goes down exponentially before it flatlines at 2 hours.
It does crater.
Yeah. It's a very different experience. But it's you know, yeah, like having those set. This is when we're playing. This is, mm-hmm. These are the rules while we're playing. And like, this is when we're going to take our breaks. I actually tell everybody now, like, take a break every 2 hours. Just say like, hey, you know, we're going to 10 minutes. How's everybody doing? You know? And then, you know, that gives a chance too. If there was a safety concern that came up that nobody voiced, you know, that gives them that an option too. So
I would like to hear about, because we touched on it, but like, what does the pacing look like for like a 90-minute game versus like an 8-hour game? Like, how do you keep people engaged in those times?
Yeah. So for like a short game, I mean, the thing that I've learned about like running short games is it's my general philosophy is put your foot on the gas and get to the part that's fun and get to the part that people want to be doing. The story that I have for this is there's a game that I played. There was a party of one session that we did that it's a fine episode, but like I look back on it with regret every single time. It was a spy game. It was a heist game. The premise was like, we're going to break into a casino. We're going to rob a casino. And the structure of the game that is on the episode, the session that we played was character gets the orders to rob a casino. Character meets the key players in the casino. Character cases out the joint. Character does a little gambling to get to ingratiate himself. Character gets to a hotel room where he meets the other players that are going to help him break into the casino. And done. We didn't do the thing that we wanted to do, which was rob a casino. And so, like, to me, like, love with all the love in the world, get to the point. You know, if this is a game about robbing a casino, we are starting leverage dials, standing at the floor of the casino going, we're ready to rob this thing. If this is a fighting game or a wrestling game or whatever, like, we're going to do the thing. You know what I mean? I think to me, that's my philosophy on short games is we are here to do something and make sure that you are pacing in such a way that like, that's the thing that we're spending time doing.
I think that's the one of the systems that has come up that's really helped with that is the Blaze in the Dark, like Powered by the Dark, you know, where it's like, okay, we're going to go rob this thing. This is what we're doing. And we're doing it right now when something comes up.
Jump it in.
Yeah, then the flashbacks. Fun to pace those games.
So one, there is a specific adventure that we played through in Dungeon Crawl Classics, which was delightful because it was basically set up as a fantasy heist kind of situation. And it was all real time. The portal opens every 100 years. You got 2 hours of real time to get in and out. Or you're stuck here for 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
I love a timer.
That's fun. That's really fun. That's really fun.
Throw a clock in there. That's great. A real clock.
Games with a real clock go crazy.
It is particularly useful in that game because that is a game where it rewards caution and moving carefully and slowly and not getting eaten by monsters or traps. Having a strong time pressure like that is delightful because it forces you into a real rough situation and forces you to be real creative.
I was curious, Jason, as a game designer, like, what is your thought process when you're designing a game that's supposed to be like under 2 hours? Like, what do you put in there to accomplish that goal and make it engaging for players?
Fundamentally, it's you need to ensure that the players can connect with their characters as quickly as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, one easy way to do it would be you are all playing trademarked people like Marvel Heroic was fabulous because you could say, all right, I am Storm. I know who Storm is. I will go be Storm. So you don't have to explain that. You don't have to get used to that kind of pacing or character or motivation. So I find that's particularly useful, but it's also you have to make sure that you've got a lot of mechanisms that are very quick to pick up, very adaptable without much need for slow buildup.
I also kind of think that there's something to be said just along the lines of like connecting with the characters. It's great to have the archetypes and tropes that you're kind of introducing in that element be very clear. If you're doing an action game, you're like a Rambo type character. People know what that looks like. And if somebody wants to play the Rambo character, they can just play it like Rambo if they want to.
I think it's also interesting because sometimes when I'm running like one shots, especially when we do one shots for kids with YDS or I'm doing it for friends, sometimes I'll encourage them to like find a character in their archives and make a character in this system based off them. So they have that immediate connection. So they know like, this is Raka and I know what she does. I know who she is. And I don't have to spend time like fleshing out with them like this whole character arc when we only have like 90 minutes to do something with. And so that can also be a really good strategy. It's just like if you have a character already and you can just like modify them into a new system, that can be really helpful as well. And that might be a good suggestion for your players to bring to the table.
Let me throw this in there. How do you keep players engaged when time is short and spotlight sharing is tricky?
I mean my answer is admittedly biased, which is have one other person at the table. It admittedly makes it pretty easy when you're putting a spotlight on one person. Admittedly, I am an edge case in this. I recognize that. But honestly, I think it goes in line with my previous thing of like, get to the good stuff, get to the fireworks factory. I've often heard it said that like items on a character sheet or decisions made in play are flags for things you want to happen. If I make a character that is a wizard, I want to cast a spell. If I put on my character sheet that my character is the daughter of the devil, I probably want the devil, like, I want to engage with the devil in some capacity. If I've got night, it is, you open a Batman comic book because you want to see Batman punch a guy, you want to see Batman solve a mystery. The things that are on the table, those immediate beats, it is finding a way to honor those beats. I will talk specifically, there is a game that I wrote years ago called Mission Accomplished. There's a salute in the title. It's not in the text. It's assumed. The salute is assumed. And the premise is it is entirely designed to be like a 2-hour in and out game for like a large group. And the premise is that you are all spies. You have returned from a spy mission and now you have to meet with HR to like go over everything and have like a debriefing meeting. And what you do in that game is you literally write down like something another player did that's good, something another player is bad. And I think like my view is it is very physically and tangibly that process in that game. But I think it's a similar process for me in any game, which is the GM player takes all of those written down character beats, arranges them in an order and goes, this is a cohesive narrative thread, but that includes all of these spotlight moments that are what we want the characters to be doing in play. I know what I want each member of the Justice League to do in this Justice League adventure. I just got to arrange them in a way where the Flash has to run at something, Green Lantern's got to make a construct, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
If everybody kind of has their role and whatnot established, then yeah, I love the concept that like the stuff people are writing out of the character sheet is your map, and to kind of like go with that. One of my favorite things about doing this podcast is that every episode so far has had one thing. I'm like, oh, that's something I just need to put in my kit. I feel like that. Yeah. Just write down a few things. Like, somebody put this on there. I like that.
I personally, I like this idea that the character sheet is just like your window to the soul almost of like, this is what I want to see happen. I have some like players, especially kids, who will just like write me a little story and I'll be like, okay, so they sent this 3-page story. They spent like 2 pages talking about the relationship with the devil that they have. I guess the devil's going to be showing up in our game. And those things are just really helpful to have as well. I think that's all I wanted to say to that point. But I truly do love a character sheet. I love getting a character sheet ahead of time. And that might be like a GM prep strategy. I feel like sometimes people are really like scared to show their character sheet. They're like, I want this big surprise. Your GM is your friend. They want to have like cool experiences for you. So encourage your players to share their character sheets with you ahead of time so you can create those like interesting like story beats in a session or throughout a campaign that you can work with there.
And I have had players that won't show me their character sheet and then are upset that their character doesn't have much to do.
Yeah.
And I think conversely, kind of coming in from the opposite perspective, something that I've done as a GM that I think is really effective is if I've got 90 minutes, if I've got 2 hours, I'll tell the players point blank, like, this is where you're going to be. Here is like the opening. Speaking of playing copyrighted characters, for the last like year and change, we've been doing this like free form role play Batman actual play. And every session we'll kind of say like, here's the situation. Here's the beats of the mystery. You tell me what questions Batman has, and like giving the players enough so that they can kind of sit down at the table and go like, okay, here's how I'm cracking this case, or here's how we're robbing the casino. Putting those players in that mindset so that they are coming in immediately with plans and objectives and things, like, it's kind of the opposite approach that's also going to speed things up and say, okay, great, we're getting to the good stuff because I don't need to set the stage. I've already given you those stage beats in advance for when you sit down at the table.
Jason, you play, you run games at cons, and so I kind of want to hear about like that experience, because sometimes you don't know what they're coming in with. This might just be like some random Joe from the street who's like, here is my amazing character. It's mine, though. Like, what does that look like for you? What's the experience?
So here is rule one of running a convention game. If you have short time pressures, give them the pregen. Make them very simple pre-generated character so that they can walk in and see, I have four buttons. All right. And I have a motivation here of liberate all the goblins. Excellent. I know what I want to do. I have four options here. Jump, stab, seduce, and barter. Okay. Those are the tools I have. This is what I want to do. Go. As opposed to everyone bring your level six character. Because everyone bring your level six characters is exciting, but that works better for an existing social dynamic, not for complete strength.
That's also, I didn't even think about like, the social dynamic. Like, you have no idea how these players will interact with each other or even what play types they are. Usually ahead of time. I don't know if you have any contact with them ahead of time whatsoever.
As a game convention organizer, yeah, you rarely have any contact. You just show up and, hey, what's this game? I have no idea what this game is. It sounded cool. It's a challenge. But I rely on one specific piece of advice from at least Monster Hearts 1, probably Monster Hearts 2, drive characters like stolen cars. That is my motto for short game. Short one-shots? Hi, these are the resources that you technically have to be careful about spending. Normally, if we expect you to live, go for it. You want to ride the nuclear bomb as it falls out of the sky? Enjoy it.
That's such a good, I feel like it's a good caveat. Like, there's certain actions here that if you want to live, do those. If not, we will be ending in 3 hours regardless.
Yeah, drive it like you stole it.
Yeah.
The thing I found when I've run convention games is that with pre-gens, I always like to put a few notes into like, and the notes are like who these people are in the world. The stat line will usually tell you what the character can do, but that was one of the things that I, you know, three or four notes. It's like, this is who this person is. This is how this person interacts with this person or something like that. And ever since I started doing that, it changed very distinctly. Like, people read those like, oh, okay, well, I know I'm talking to that, and I don't like this guy very much, and you know, that kind of thing.
I do want to kind of ask a question that's it's a twist on one of the ones that we gave you, but I think that we've been talking about a lot of the things that we had already just put in the discussion questions. But I want to see, like, when you start to see someone in a game, whether it's short or long, starting to kind of disengage with the content, what do you do as a GM?
So there's a few ways to deal with it. My most important tool is active listening, and I am trying to determine the cause of the disengagement. If I see someone on their phone, but I've seen that they've been distracted by things constantly, that may just be self-managing, ADHD, etc. And they may be fully engaged. They just need to be on their phone playing.
In my group, it's Balatro, if that's what you want to use.
Yeah, Balatro, in order to be able to concentrate on what's going on in the game. Okay, great. Not a problem. Sometimes it's just my ADHD meds just shut off. I have a table with three ADHD people, so I have to pay attention to all of these bits.
Sure.
The meds just died on one of them. So I'll just let you be unconscious now and focus on the people who have energy. Other times it's because there's nothing that they can do. On those times, I will shift the narrative in their direction. I'll set up a problem that their character is uniquely designed to solve. And basically, I am putting out an option, and if they do not take it, they don't have to. The thing that I try to avoid is forced engagement, because I know that 60% of that of the time for forced engagement, it is the correct thing to do. 40% of the time, it's not. I don't like that ratio. By contrast, setting out a table of, we have this 17-level custom lock to be able to break into this building. Madam Thief, do you have any expertise to bring to the table? I find that tends to work more easily and more effectively.
I think there's sometimes where when somebody's disengaged too, and I'm a check-in person. I check in all the time. And I've had times mm-hmm. where people are like, I'm just enjoying what everybody's doing. I think we've even talked about that on episodes of this at some point. And so I think it's a case of like you said, there's that 40% of the time where if you do a forced engagement, then that person is suddenly going to be like, oh, now I have to entertain. Like, these people are so entertaining. Now I have to be as entertaining as them.
My thing is, I will go big for the cop-out answer, I think, and it's exactly along the lines of yours as well, which is the greatest tool we have for a lot of issues is that we are people at a table and that our experience relating to one another is more important than the game. And so, like, if somebody seems disengaged, especially if we're talking, if we've only got, like, a 90 minutes or 2 hours, like, a 30-second check-in of, hey, just checking in. Like, you good? Like, you know, playing virtually is great for this because then it's a Discord DM that just says, hey, checking in. Want to make sure you're doing good. Anything we can be doing differently? And then if you get an answer that's like, I'm not feeling this scene, then I can pivot. Or it might be I'm enjoying what everybody else is doing and I get a quick thumbs up emoji and we move on our way. But like, I am very quick to break the fiction and just say, hey, I actually want to check in and make sure you're having a good time with this because especially if it's a short game, we don't have a lot of time for you not to be having a good time. And if it's a long game, then if you're not having a good time, that might be you not having a good time for a very long time. And that sounds miserable. So like, I will be very quick to address that over the table and just say, hey, I want to check in. I want to see where we're at. Let me know if you're good. If you're good, no further conversation will be had.
I think that really goes back to also knowing your players, knowing their characters, mm-hmm. and like to what you were saying, Jason, like Master Thief, like we now have a lock. I like to check in with people and like give them an opportunity to engage if they want to. But I think this is something I think a lot about like in paid game versus like casual, like for fun games. In a paid game, I'm a lot more locked into making sure everyone's engaged because, like, that is an experience that they are putting effort and resources into in a different way than someone who is playing a casual game with me. I might care a little less if my friends are disengaged on a Saturday. Things are happening. It's the world. We're hanging out as friends as opposed to one of, like, my YDS sessions with that. And so I think those are kind of really interesting takes on disengagement.
I think that's also a very interesting point when thinking about long games in general, which is like I also have a much higher patience for if somebody's not vibing right now, like I might check in with them in a half hour. I might check in with them after the scene, but like we're locked in for 12 hours. There's going to be points where I'm checked out. There's going to be points where you're checked out. Like we just kind of got to let the experience be what it is.
If I can jump in on a little sidebar and tangent.
Yeah.
So with regards to the forced engagement, there's something very interesting done in the game Microscope. It specifically is designed so that there's a rotating focus, but it basically has strong rules that say when it is the person's turn, you cannot interrupt them, you cannot contribute. They are on the hot seat. And that is part of the core design itself, which works for some people and does some really interesting things in encouraging quiet people to contribute and making forced space to stop the alpha improvisers from just chewing the scenery constantly and stepping on all over them. That kind of forced restraint is fascinating as a design tool, but conversely, you can also simply say, here is a prompt. Who has an idea on what to do off of this prompt? And you simply lay it out and let whoever has creative inspiration be the one to run with it.
I'll do that sometimes with kids, especially if I see that we have a quieter kid who I know would love to roleplay, would love to do something, but doesn't have that space. Well, I'll say, hey, Doc, what would you do with all of these unfolding events in front of you? The bard is putting on a concert. The fighter is doing his thing and fighting. Like, what does your character make of that madness, and what would they be doing right now? Even just to give them that, like, little spotlight, that little microscope, that little lens on them for a moment. And that could be a really helpful tool just for those quieter people.
It's funny, you mentioning microscope is really good too, because that was, I think that was the first time I played a game where, no, if you're not, if it's not you, you have to close your mouth now. And I kind of struggled with that a little bit. Like, it shut my dumb face up. Like, I think I remember sitting there, and I'm not going to do it now. I was just like, that's not great. But I would like put my hand over my mouth, just like, no, shut up. One of the things I think that you know, we've kind of discovered is, as we look at different professionals and everything, is that there's always these fun tools that you could pull from different systems and everything. And I like the idea that, like, clocks will have engagement, and that means that, you know, if you're doing a short game, you've got that short game. And I like the idea that if it's a spotlight like situation, then you have spotlight. When somebody has the spotlight, it's them. Nobody can interrupt them. Yeah, it's always just cool to see the toolkit grow.
Peer review is our section of the show where, as nerds, we talk about other nerds who are doing research about nerd things. Today, we're actually taking a little step back from specifically TTRPG research, because I was thinking about long and short games, and I don't know how many people are doing research about that. But what I do know there's a lot of research about is the human attention span, and I think that's a lot that we can connect back to this topic that we've already touched on today. In today's article, I'll give you that long title and the authors as well, from 2014, we have Sustaining Attention to Simple Tasks, a Meta-Analytic Review of the Neuromechanisms of Vigilant Attention by R. Langner and S. Eckhoff. This is an interesting one. It's a long one. I don't know if anyone got a chance to kind of like look over its abstract, but we're talking about vigilant attention, which, Doc, Jason, Jeff, have you heard of the term vigilant attention?
No, but I love it already.
Just to cite it, it was coined by Robertson and Garavin, and Robertson and O'Connell.
No.
So the definition of vigilant attention provided by Robertson and Garavin and Robertson and O'Connell is standing attention to monotonous, intellectually unchallenging tasks. And I think that is a very interesting angle to pay attention to.
I was really drawn to this article because I was just thinking about all the long games I've sat through where we're spending time looking up mechanics of a game, or I am waiting for someone to finish up a plot point that has literally nothing to do with my character, or maybe we are in a very short game and we're just like still talking with the merchant when I want to get to that meat and potatoes of the game. And so I was thinking a lot about that while I was reading this article. And in this meta-analysis, they do go over quite a few different papers talking about vigilant attention span. But it's really talking about those monotonous tasks that just require more effort to stay attention, and then over time, decrease our ability to pay attention. This is called, I have it in my notes, vigilance decrements. And so, like, just again, that attention span gets lower and lower and lower as we're doing more of these things. For GMs and for players, I think it's something to think about in your game design or in your session design. What are these like monotonous tasks that you have that take away from not only like player enjoyment, but also their overall attention span? If you're running a 10-hour game, what are the things that you might need to cut out in those like 2-hour, 3-hour blocks that you're running it so that you can make it to the end without everyone just like on their backs, like, we're done, we're tired, it's over. And so I did want to hear a little bit from you guys, a little bit different of our peer review this time, of like, what are some of those like monotonous tasks that you consider in a game when you're planning those long or short games that you can remove out of time? I know, Jeff, you talked about this earlier, and what sounds like a very fun session that I would have enjoyed listening to if play with one. But like, what are some of those tasks that you guys are thinking about? Like, what comes to mind with this?
It depends on your system. Many traditional systems will have more involved, mechanically robust combat systems that have multi-steps, divvying out responsibilities to different people. So it is very much a wait, now I have to go here and do 7 steps in this order, and then I am done, and now I'm wait. Honestly, I find that the waiting is the painful part and the repetitive part that is most draining. The active is fine. So as an analogy to cite some game literature, I'd like to point out Ralph Kostler's Theory of Fun. In Theory of Fun, Kostler presents the idea of a difficulty curve graph. As your skill moves along the x-axis and the difficulty can move up the y-axis, and you have to stay in a certain band around that curve to be engaged. If it is too difficult for your skill, you get frustrated. If it is too easy for your skill, you get bored. Maintaining the difficulty of gameplay and the amount of engagement that a given participant gains out of it, I think that's essential to maintaining this energy and avoiding being obliged to resort to vigilant attention, because that is a different phenomenon entirely. It's a flow state. That is goal.
It's like an attention resonance in that range. Like if you can just kind of keep it, it's like Flappy Bird. You're starting to fall. Just get you up there. And, yeah.
I actually really like that analogy because, like Flappy Bird, like the levels change, and so like throughout a game, those levels are going to change. And I think we've talked a lot about communicating with our players today and talking to them and checking on their energy levels as we play. I think that's really important.
I think for me, especially when I'm thinking about like a short session, this is podcast Jeff locking in, which is like, There is nothing less engaging than a single minute in a 60-minute session of, hold on, I got to double check something. And so like my view is always cheat sheets, and also being willing to get something wrong and saying like us doing the thing is more important than following the correct procedure. If I don't know a rule, if we're not confident about something, if we're not certain about it, then I'm going to throw it out the window and we're just going to figure out something on the fly.
I feel a lot of times when it's just like when you have a disagreement of a GM, or you're going over like a ruling, sometimes, especially in those short games, that can take a lot of time, and that's time that you could be like playing the game. And so I've definitely seen that too.
The word I was going to say was shopping. We never need players to shop during a game. Send me a message. I want to go talk to somebody and see if they have this. They have it. It's now in your inventory. You're fine.
Go. Just subtract the money.
Yeah, just subtract the money. It's fine. Oh, I don't quite have the money. Oh, you find it. Like, it's fine.
Alrighty, let's wrap up today's session with one final question. Jason and Jeff, what's one thing you wish every player understood just about how that length of a session really impacts your role or the role of your GM? It's our key takeaways section. What should one thing that you wish everyone knew?
I wish everyone knew that they need to calibrate their attention and energy to the length of the session and go into it saying, this is a 1-hour session. This is a sugar high.
Yeah.
We're going fast. We're jumping in. No time to dilly-dally. This is a long session. We're going to take this at a more gentle pace, and we're going to let this evolve naturally.
Get ready to lock in or settle in almost, depending on the length of again.
Yeah, lock in or settle in is a good way to put it.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
I think for me, I'm going to take a little bit of the opposite approach, which is to say, Jason, you're wrong.
Ooh, it's about time.
No, I think my one takeaway is, with the caveat that I play with adults. If you don't play with adults, this sentence might not be as applicable, but we're all adults here. We are going to have let's be honest and open about, we've got an hour. If we get to a point where like, hey, I'm not going to finish everything I got written in the next 25 minutes, do we want to skip ahead? We'll skip ahead. If we are like, hey, I really want to get to 3 or more things, let's find some extra time. Cool. I think to me, and similarly with those 8-hour sessions, if it's like, hey, I'm enjoying this, but I gotta go out. I have to get some food. I have to sit in a place with people for an hour. I will be back later. My go-to line is always, we as people are more important than the game and the story, and that humanity into the session. You know what I mean? If it means cutting some plot beats out, great. If it means letting a character disappear for an hour so that somebody can go sit, lay on the floor and dissociate for a little while, that's beautiful. Regardless of length, we are people and we should account for our needs within those constructs as much as possible.
I love that both those statements kind of like somewhat contradict, but also like, yeah, you need both those things.
To be clear, the reason why I'm saying know what your energy you're coming in,
yeah,
is because so that you can get maximum enjoyment out of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
If you are in a place where you can't do a high octane fast burn, you may not be getting the full enjoyment out of a 1 hour session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so these are complementary.
100%. We're exactly in agreement. It is know what you're getting into and also know what the session expects or know what your fellow players expect, but also know what you need. Like, it really, those I think are very complementary ideas.
Before we go, let's give our guests a moment to tell you where you can find them. Starting with Jason, where can we find you?
You can find me at genesisoflegend.com or at the RPG Design Panelcast, presenting the very best recorded panels and seminars about game design and publishing.
Amazing. And Jeff?
Hi, I'm Jeff Stormer. I'm the Great Clown Pagliacci of Tabletop RPG Podcasts and Streams. You can find my work at jeffstormer.com. You can find the book that I wrote, The Ultimate Fantasy Character Creator in Stores, and you can find me on social media at jeffstormer.gobirds.online.
Thank you both for spending time with us on the Forever GMs podcast. If you want to support the show, check out our Patreon for bonus content and behind-the-scenes goodness. You can also find us on TikTok and Blue Sky, and we're always looking for ideas on what we should tackle next. Reach out on socials or email us at forevergms@docpalindrome.com. And remember, Forever GMs never stop leveling up the table. Have a good one.